Welcome again to the Evolution Seminar Series. Well, today we're lucky to have Dick DeVielzig, and he's from the he's a professor in the veterinary school, and he's in the Department of Pathobiological Sciences. And his research has been about sort of ocular and dental morphology and the morphology of disease. And these days, I guess he's focusing mostly on ocular stuff. And he's going to tell us today about the anatomy of the vertebrate eye. So thank you for coming.
Thank you. So I'm a professor of pathology at the veterinary school. And the job I'm hired to do is to be part of a team that provides the autopsy and biopsy service for the veterinary school. All my career, I've had a special interest in ocular pathology, and over the last 5 or 6 years, I have made arrangements so that I can do just ocular pathology. And for the most part, that's centered around a mammalian eye pathology service. So veterinary ophthalmologists around the country and to some extent around the world will send me specimens of eyes that have been removed for medical reasons so as to provide a diagnosis. Those are overwhelming majority dog and cat eyes, and of not much interest in terms of comparative anatomy or evolutionary biology. All this time, I've always nurtured a special interest in comparative anatomy and tried to make contacts with exotic animal veterinarians or zoos or aquariums or wildlife biologists that have access to interesting, not necessarily pathological, in fact, preferably normal collected soon after death specimens. And over the last several years, I've started working with a man named Ivan Schwab. I don't know, some people here probably know Ivan. He is a medical ophthalmologist at the University of California at Davis. He's a corneal specialist, and he, like myself, is an enthusiast for comparative ophthalmology. One thing I'm not going to talk about is evolution. I'm not an evolutionary biologist. I know virtually anything I would say about evolution would be very sophomoric, especially in this audience. But I'm hoping that there'll be an obvious connection between the comparative morphology and the evolutionary significance of it. My real hope is that people here will find the possibility of having access to my collection of interest in their own work, because I'm very interested in making this material available. Most of what I'm going to show you, most of what we have in the collection is available in the form of paraffin blocks. Many of the small and rare specimens is available only in microscope slides, because in the process of recording the anatomy, we've sliced through the eye, no longer have access to the paraffin blocks. But we do have contacts and what have you. We could possibly get more information. I've limited this talk to the vertebrate eye, and I hope that I'll be able to get through this. I have quite a bit of material. I'm going to go fairly rapid through this, so if you're not at all familiar with ocular anatomy, you may space out as I go through this. But I wanted to put in as much basic information as possible. We do have, perhaps less impressive, but we do also, partly because of my work with Ivan, we do have also a collection of invertebrate specimens as well, not nearly as comprehensive as our vertebrates. That would, I think, probably be almost impossible, but we have tried in both our vertebrates and our invertebrates to make specific attention on species that have that kind of evolutionary mileposts. So I'll cover some of that. And I think I can do this by just getting that. Again, this cladograms that are that I'll show are usually borrowed from the internet or don't necessarily indicate a deep understanding of evolution, but just as a matter of keeping track and cataloging the various species that we have. So this on the right is a list of available vertebrate species, with the exception of dinosaurs, I guess. We have specimens involving every group here, except the one listed right there. Let's start out with the hagfish and lamprey. The hagfish specimen that we got is by way of Ivan Schwab. It's the Pacific hagfish, and our lamprey specimen is our own Great Lakes lamprey, and was provided to me by the DNR fisheries people here in Wisconsin. So these, of course, are chordates, not vertebrates. They do have ocular structures that show morphological elements that suggest that their eye is developed along a sort of a general scheme, morphologic scheme, of the vertebrate eye, not any of the invertebrate types. But there's quite a dramatic difference in the morphology of the eye between the hagfish and the lamprey, and I realize that there's kind of a energy and a swirl about the significance of that, how closely these two very ancient species are related, and whether one is primal to the other. I'm not going to try and solve those problems, but I'll just show you some what I think are very interesting facts. So these are animals that have a notochord that persists throughout life. They have a number of other characteristics that separate them from most of the vertebrates in terms of their being a very primitive structure. Enough said about that. Let's talk about the eyes. So this is a hagfish. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the hagfish. It's an incredible animal. It's an animal that lives deep in the ocean and feeds on carrion. I guess we can all be thankful that when whales die, they sink. And that's when whale flesh is one of the main things that hagfish feed on. They don't have an external eye. Instead, they have in their head end, they have a non-pigmented patch of regular skin that covers over where the eye should be. Another thing that I'll talk about a little bit later is their eye is wired to the brain like a pineal gland, not like an image forming eye. And I'll show you this can't be an image forming eye. It's a light sensing eye, but it's not an image forming eye. And they don't have a pineal gland, so I'm not going to get into a lot of speculation about what all that means. But that's just it. They have a two layered retina as opposed to all the rest of the vertebrate eyes. Have three neuron, there are multiple layers of the retina, but there are three neuron layers of the retina. But the hagfish has just a two layer. There's no cornea and no lens, which is the main reason why this can't be an image forming eye. So this is a cross section of the hagfish, and you can see the integument, the skin coming over the surface. And Janice Locum is the histologist at the medical school. She's a magician in terms of her ability to accurately get good histologic images. She was able to find this eye, despite the fact there's no pigment, and of course it's minuscule in terms of its size. It's embedded in the tissue. Here's a higher magnification. It has a two-layered retina, as advertised. We didn't really get a good section of the optic nerve as it leaves the retina, but here's the optic nerve getting ready to leave the retina and progress back to the brain. It's held in place by a very, very thin tissue, which we'll say analogous to the sclera. And remember, this is not the surface of the animal. This is a surface of a cavitated space in the body cavity, and so it doesn't have anything either resembling a cornea or a lens. So there's no ability of this animal to focus light on the retina. This is a light-sensing organ, not an image-forming organ. If you're not familiar with the hagfish, it's primitive in many, many ways, but it has the most sophisticated mucus-producing tissues of the body of any animal in existence, I believe. So then let's talk a little bit about lampreys. This is a specimen of an adult lamprey, and you can see that there's a very recognizable eye. It makes contact with the surface. There's a cornea. There's a pupil, which you can see there. And this is the larva. The larva does not have a surface connected eye. It has an eye embedded in the tissue, much like the lamprey, but it's different in many ways. It's among those, the fact that it has a lens and a three-layered retina. Also, it's wired to the brain like a image-forming eye, as opposed to a pineal gland, and the lamprey also does have a bilobed, asymmetrically bilobed pineal gland. So here's the histology of the lamprey eye, very much like all the rest of the eyes I'm going to show you. There's a a round lens, which is perfect for vision underwater. There's a three-layered retina. There's pigmentation, which the remember the hagfish did not have. There's a very, very thin sclera. You can see the scleral region right here, pigmented choroid. There's photoreceptors very much oriented the way they are in other species. This is something I'll talk about for a while, and that is that the cornea is continuous with the skin. The cornea is not does not stretch around and continuous with the sclera, which is what we see in most of our vertebrate eyes. And then this is a cross-section of the larval form. These animals are larvae for about 5 years, and I don't know what transformation they go through, but then they become, then they get their adult phenotype. This eye looks very much like an embryo. If you section an embryo from a vertebrate, it has most of the features of this eye. It has a fairly small lens. Most of the retina has an embryological appearance, although there's a central portion of the retina right around the optic nerve that is already fully developed, even in the larvae. And I don't know in terms of years of being a larvae that would be. There is a modification of the skin over the eye, but basically the eye is embedded in the body. It doesn't have a true cornea over the surface in the larval lamprey. It does have a complex layering of the cornea and a structure here, which is very much morphologically anyway, very much like the annular ligament that we'll see in some of the later animals. So next, the sharks and rays. My collection of shark and ray eyes could be bigger, but we have several examples of different types. There is a cartilaginous sclera for the first time. Remember, the lamprey had just a very thin fibrous sclera. There's no muscle in the ciliary body. There's a smooth muscle attached to the ventral aspect of the lens, presumably to move the lens in and out for near and distant focus. There's still a double cornea. There's both a scleral and a skin element of the cornea, which is a feature we'll see for a while here. There's no complex interassociation between the pigment around the photoreceptor cells of the retina and the retinal cells, which is, again, something we'll see throughout the rest of the evolutionary tree of the vertebrates, with the exception of mammals. So here's some histology of shark and ray eyes, and again, I'm in most of these stopping points, I'm going to show you generalities. Of course, there are species differences among all of these, but I'm going to show you sort of general features that I think characterize the group as a whole.
What is the advantage of the double cornea?
I think it's just evolutionary. It seems to. We see it in the fishes and then in tadpoles among amphibians, but then we no longer see it anymore. We get into a different manifestation of it in snakes, but I think it's just an interesting sidebar to that is we're beginning to look at a variety of blind cavefish, and loss of the cornea, loss of the skin aspect of the cornea seems to be a common feature in the small number of blind cavefish we've looked at so far. So
Dick,
great question, but I'm not sure. Margaret probably knows.
All the Napistone vertebrates prior to the water to land transition have this feature. This one. Is that right?
Yeah. I don't know about salamanders. Frogs and toads in the tadpoles have this feature.
Yes. And so what is the sclera derived from?
So the sclera is seen very early. We see that in both the hagfish and the lamprey. It's collagenous connective tissue, but I don't know it's.
Mesoderm.
I'm assuming it's mesoderm, but I'm not sure. A lot of things around in and around the eye are neural crest, but I can't tell you for sure about the sclera. For instance, a lot of the cornea is neural crest. At least the mammalian cornea. So again, this is up here mostly just to show you what we do and don't have. We have specimens of several different species of lungfish. We We have sturgeon. I'd like to get, we've got native paddlefish here in Wisconsin, and I have feelers out to get a good specimen of paddlefish eye, but we don't. And then really we have just a scatter. We don't have a gar pike, which is another one we should certainly be able to get our hands on. And then we have a scattering of different teleosta fish. So again, this is these are general features. The lungfish and the sturgeon that we have are characterized by the a very, very thick scleral cartilage. They also have a very thin choroid, which is in the teleost fish, they tend to get a very thick choroid. They're also lacking a gland I'll show you later on called the, it's not really a gland, they're lacking a vascular structure, a vascular rete called the choroidal gland, which is sort of directly attached to the gills. It's thought to jack up the oxygen level in the very oxygen needy photoreceptor cells. But these are lacking in both the lungfish and the sturgeon examples that we have. They do have three chromic variants of photoreceptor cells, and they have a that's the only picture of the sturgeon. Again, a very primitive fish. We have a we're fortunate here in Wisconsin in that we have access to sturgeon eyes because we have, because our DNR controls the sturgeon levels in Lake Winnebago. And the specimens I have are all from juveniles, so they're all very small eyes, but I think that they're appropriate. Again, no, just like the sharks and rays, no muscles except for the muscle supporting the lens. There's a feature that I've not seen in any other fish, and that's a guanine choroidal tapetum, and I'll show you a picture of that and explain what that means. We do, for the first time, see some elements of a complex interaction between the melanin pigment of the retinal pigment epithelium and the photoreceptor cells, but it's not, morphologically anyway, it's not as complex as we see in the higher fish. And again, I don't know the significance of that. So you can see this is a centimeter rule here, so I have a very small specimen from a juvenile sturgeon. I'll show you, we'll be looking at some other fish, but notice that the choroid, which is the vascular supporting structure behind the retina, is very thin, unlike the other fish where it gets to be very, very thick. Here's the retina, many different categories of photoreceptors. Like I said, three chromic variants. There are both rods and cones as well. And this is a polarized image here. You can see this structure, but down here is made up of guanine. This is just colored, Photoshop color change to highlight that structure. We do have, so the tapetum lucidum is a reflective structure. It's present, its presence usually is a hallmark of animals that need to have adequate vision in dim light. The theory being that light going in reflects off the tapetum and passes through the photoreceptor layer twice, enhancing the likelihood of recognition as it passes through the retina. And higher fish have a tapetum as well, but it's often the guanine is actually in the photoreceptor cells themselves, so that would be referred to as a retinal tapetum. The pigmentation in the RPE cells is segmented in the sturgeon. Again, I'm not sure if that's another indication of a preference, an adaptation for dim light, or whether that's an evolutionary step, probably the former. And then the higher teleosts always have cartilage, sometimes have bone in the sclera. That's the first time we see bone in the sclera along the tree of life. They have a very well-developed retractor lentis muscle, which helps with accommodation by moving the lens obliquely, actually, or forward and backward. They have a highly developed vascular structure in the choroid. Again, this is just because I say they have it doesn't mean that every single species has it, but it's widespread throughout the teleosts. They have a complex interassociation between melanin and their photoreceptor cells, whereby in a bright light situation, the melanin will move forward to shade the photoreceptors, and under dim light circumstances, the melanin will move backwards to expose the photoreceptors. And some fish have, for the first time now, we have a adaptation of the retina for high visual acuity, for high numbers of cones and high numbers of ganglion cells, just the way we use our fovea for reading, etc. Again, trichromatic color vision. They have the presence of they still have this presence of both a scleral and a cutaneous elements to their cornea. And then the blood supply to the inner portion of the retina, if they have a modification, it will be through what's called a papillary process. It's a vascular structure that extends into the vitreous and either forms a vascular kind of a bridge in the vitreous or branches out very much like our own retinal blood vessels would, but not in the retina itself as you see it in mammals, but within the vitreous. So an interesting vascular supply. This is just, I'll recommend any, if you have available to you Wall's book from 1942, The Vertebrate Eye and its Adaptive Radiations. It's it's so comprehensive and complete and understandable. It gives me the goosebumps to read it sometimes, even now. I read something in a recently published article and I go back to Wall's and there it is, embedded in a paragraph somewhere. It's amazing. So here's just a histology picture from us. Animals that primarily we see underwater usually have a very round, dense lens because all of their light refraction does not occur at the surface between the curved cornea and the air, but it has to be done by the lens. You can see the double aspect of the cornea quite well in this specimen, perhaps why I included that picture. And here's this vascular reti structure. This particular species has two. We've seen as many as three, and then there are some, we will occasionally come across teleosts where we haven't been able to find a vascular reti. Oops. Here's this, we saw this in the lamprey as well. Here's a structure whose physiology I don't understand at all, but it's an avascular mesenchymal ligament between the cornea and the iris called the annular ligament. I don't understand why it's there or what it does, but it's morphologically quite distinct and quite recognizable, so it's kind of a morphological hallmark. Here's an example of this reti structure. This is a double one. They're fused in the middle. They'll receive their blood supply from the anterior aspect of the gills, and then they'll feed their blood supply into the choriocapillaries. You can see these blood vessels right underneath the retina that supply, a vascular supply, to the very oxygen-needy photoreceptors of the fish. Here's an example of the retractor lentis muscle. There's also the lens is then strung across the front of the eye because it's attached with a ligament on the other side. That muscle will move the lens obliquely back and forth and allow for, to at least some extent, near vision as well as far vision. And this is this is from Wall's. It illustrates that process. Here's just a histologic picture showing that this is a tuna fish, and you can see this tuna fish has a bridge-like vascular structure which extends up into the vitreous, providing blood supply to the inner portion of the retina. And this is not the tuna fish, but this is another fish in which we've captured that vascular structure, the choroidal process in the image. Here's an example. This is a fish retina, and you can see that what I was trying to talk to you about, the pigment in the photoreceptors. This fish, you can predict, would have died in the bright light. Most of the specimens we have, fish die in the bright light because that's the time of people. Most of the fish we see are dyed for some reason, or put to sleep for some reason. But we do occasionally get fish in which the melanin is all retracted back, and then you can predict that that's a fish that died in the dim light. This is a walleye, and a walleye has a tapetum like the sturgeon, but in this case the tapetum is actually in the retinal pigment epithelial cell. So here's the regular view. If you use polarized light, the guanine will highlight, and then I can't remember how I did this. Did that with Photoshop, but with white balance somehow, but gives you a nice highlight of that. We would call that, we would refer to that as a retinal tapetum, because the reflective elements are in the RPE cell of the retina. I just want to use this slide to say that Chuck Schobert in my lab has become quite enthusiastic about evolution and its relationship to our collection in the eye. He's been soliciting species of blind cavefish so we can do a morphologic comparison of different species. That collection is still quite minuscule, but I just want to say this: we are interested in sort of the process of losing structure in fish that, or fish or any other animal that might not necessarily use vision anymore. And this is a alpha nose fish. It's a murky water fish that has an electrical field. It senses prey and other things around it with an electrical field from its skin, which I don't understand at all. Notice it still has a pretty prominent eye, but the complexity of the eye has lost, has been lost. And also, in particular, the scleral aspect of the surface or the corneal morphology is changed, which might be something particularly interesting. This is a mole eye. You can see it also has a very degenerate morphology. I don't have anything more to say about that other than there it is.
In the elephant nose fish, there's a huge amount of pigment.
Actually, if you polarize that, most of that is guanine.
Oh, is it?
I don't have a picture of that, but. Amphibians, again, my collection of amphibian eyes is not the best. This is a diagram from Walls showing the generic amphibian eye. Cartilaginous sclera, none of the species that I know about have bone in their vision. They do have trichromatic vision. Just to catch you up a little bit, to remember that most mammals have only dichromatic vision, so mammals have lost some complexity of their eye, and I'll get into that in a little bit. There is still photomechanic movement within the RPE. There's a minuscule amount of smooth muscle in the choroid, which possibly, or is argued anyway, is an adaptation for accommodation for nearsighted vision. You'd think a frog having to catch flies with its tongue would have good accommodation, but I'm not sure how they do that. There's a very pronounced double cornea in the tadpole. I have two different species to illustrate that from. There's a lens that is lacking of an annular pad. I haven't gotten to the annular pad yet, but we'll talk about that when we start talking about reptile eyes. And then there is a retractor bulb eye. I'm not going to say very much about the orbit. I don't usually receive orbital tissues, but they do have retractor bulb eye muscle in their orbit. So here's some examples. These are from frogs and toads. Here's this. We're cutting near the angle. This is what they have in terms of smooth muscle. And they do have a big round lens. Probably in order to, if accommodation is going to be something that happens, in other words, adaptation for near vision, they're going to have to move that lens back and forth. And this is smooth muscle. It just seems very primitive to me. There is a cartilaginous sclera. In fact, to jump ahead, with the exception of the lamprey and the hagfish, the cartilaginous sclera is basically in all the vertebrate eyes, with the exception of mammals. Non-monitoring mammals and snakes. And then here's a bullfrog tadpole, and there's a very distinct difference between the cutaneous portion of the cornea and the scleral portion of the cornea. Photomechanic movement of photoreceptors and a very complex multi-layered retina with all manner of different categories of photoreceptor cells. So this is just a little graph. Let's see, I think. Didn't. The purpose of this is to sort of highlight the platypus. And I'll talk about the platypus eye in a bit, but put the platypus in its place. And these are just elements that would suggest ocular sophistication, in other words, enhanced ocular function, you know, based on morphology, as opposed to more primitive, less functional elements of structure of the eye. So in most of these, you can see that the purpose of this, that is color. Okay, and that's color too, okay. The color's kind of washed out here, but so the greenish blue or gray is meant to highlight those among this group that have what I have taken upon myself to call the most sophisticated structures of the eye, that have it, that would suggest enhanced function. And the red is among this group, it indicates the structural features of the eye that suggest the least sophistication or the least ability to have enhanced function. And notice that most of the ones that have the least function are in the placental mammals, all the ones here that have been designated as having the most functional are in the reptiles, and then that's just carried on as you get into birds, have incredibly sophisticated ocular structures. And then the platypus is kind of in between. There's no uveal muscle in the platypus eye, so that gets designated as the least differentiated or the least functional. Okay, reptiles. I think we're going to start out with, I think my understanding is that there's quite a bit of controversy in terms of the evolutionary development of the reptiles, and particularly with the turtles. I'm not going to suggest any evolutionary progress from any reptile group to another. Of course, we don't have access to dinosaur eyes, but I have a high suspicion that dinosaur eyes are very much like bird eyes, and those are the most sophisticated of all the eyes that I'm going to show you. But let's just look at turtle eyes. Turtles, again, have complex ocular structures. They have, for the first time, we see a modified structure at the equator of the lens, referred to as the annular pad, where the lens fibers become elongated. The thinking is that the annular pad is a structure which modulates the way pressure is expressed in the lens, modulates the way the lens can change shape. And the thinking is that, it provides an enhanced ability for the lens to have tight control and tight regulation of its shape changes, which is a feature that's important for accommodation, for adjustment for near vision. Turtles also have a very robust muscular structure in their iris, which probably allows them to, in most species, this is a feature that allows it to change the curvature of the anterior surface of the lens. And it's a modification that I think its goal is to allow for a turtle to have crisp vision both above water and below water, because in terms of the camera function of an eye, there's a big difference in how an eye functions above water and below water, the difference being the curved corneal air surface is the major refractive element of the eye in most species that see out of water. But when you go underwater, if you've ever opened your eyes underwater, you realize you don't have crisp vision, and that's because now everything is the only functional refractive element of the eye now is the lens, which really in most terrestrial animals is just a really fine focus mechanism. And so in order to have like a turtle or a penguin or a sea lion or a puffin, they have to have some mechanism for making that adaptation. And many of those animals I've listed use this mechanism of changing of the curvature of the anterior surface of the lens. And a morphological clue, I don't understand the physics of how that happens or the mechanics of how that happens, but a morphological clue to that structure is a robustly muscular iris. And then in the turtle for the first time, or I should say in the reptile for the first time, rather than smooth muscle, we now have skeletal muscle. And this doesn't illustrate it very well, but there are cross striations in the muscular structures here. Skeletal muscle, of course, is faster, stronger, and much more precise in terms of its action than smooth muscle. So I think we're going to be left imagining how much better the structure is. Also in the turtle eye, for the first time, we have oil droplets. This is just a flat mount. You take a turtle retina, peel it off, and look at it under the microscope. And these are oil droplets. You can see the oil droplets in the structure here, right here. And here, here's a clear area. And it allows a certain wavelength of light to pass into the light-sensitive areas of the outer segments of the retina. And it sort of dials up the, or it enhances the likelihood that the most appropriate light wave is signaling the most appropriate photoreceptor. Notice that there are three different colors in the, that should be right. Oh yeah, there's three different colors and then there's an uncolored one. All of these oil droplets also have the added benefit of protecting against UV light. So the uncolored one doesn't change the light, the wavelength that goes through, but it also helps to protect against UV light. And now we get into your basically your lizards. We do have a Tuatara specimen in our collection. And my understanding is that the thinking is that the Tuatara is the most primitive of the basically the lizards. This picture is up here to illustrate how, I think it's a nice illustration of how important vision is in the lizard. This is the brain and these are the two eyes dissected out. The rest of the tissues between them dissected out. The head of the lizard is mostly eye. Again, there's both cartilage and bone in the eye. There's a, in some cases, well-developed angular pad. There's skeletal muscles for accommodation and for control of the pupil. Trichromatic or more. Some of these reptiles have more than just trichromatic vision. Most of them have a fovea, not all of them, but most of them have a fovea. They have an avascular retina, but many of them have special adaptations to provide a blood supply, enhancement of oxygenation of the vitreous. The Tuatara lacks this vascular structure. And then I'm going to talk about snakes separately because they're very different. This is our Tuatara. Here's the fovea, section through the fovea, very much like a fovea you'd find in a red-tailed hawk or an eagle. And here's the optic nerve, and this picture is in here to illustrate that there is no vascular structure that extends into the vitreous. I don't know if that's because the Tuatara is primitive or there's been some other advantage to losing that structure. This is the schematic structure of the lizard eye, and this is the conus papillaris, that vascular structure that I was referring to. And here's an example of a, I can't remember what kind of a lizard this was, but here's this conus papillaris that's packed with blood vessels. But also notice it's fairly primitive in terms of its structure. It's not, I'll show you the pectin oculi from the bird. It's much more sophisticated in terms of a structure. Here's a section through the fovea in this lizard. Fovea, if you'll remember, is an adaptation of the retina for high visual acuity. So these, lizards have accommodation changes in their structure of the eye in order for them to see near and far, very closely aligned to the way birds do it. In mammals, the accommodation is a passive process. It's controlled by smooth muscle, and it depends. Ultimately, it depends upon the internal intrinsic elasticity of the lens capsule to change the shape of the lens, which is slow and not very controlled. In both the bird and the lizard, accommodation is an active process. The muscular mechanism is pushed directly on the lens. And remember, it's skeletal muscle. And these muscles, not only that, but they're anchored on bone, which is basically rigid. So they have increased rigidity, they have increased strength, they have increased innervation and preciseness, and they also have a faster action. And as well, the active mechanism of accommodation would presumably give these animals a much better ability to adjust between near and far. The support of the lens, here's this angular pad. You can see a different direction of the lens fibers near the equator of the lens as opposed to the optical portion of the lens, absent in the mammal, absent in the snake, but present in most of the reptiles. And then this structure right here is the scleral ossicle. It's the bone portion of the eye. Notice that the eye is no longer, this is a diagrammatic picture here, but it's no longer spherical. And the reason why it can be no longer spherical is because this bone here is rigid, of course, and can allow the eye to take on a shape other than just purely spherical. Here's a picture of a gecko and a chameleon showing the this Conus papillaris. Fairly primitive in terms of its structure compared to the pectin oculi in a bird. The goal here again is a highly vascular structure, and the thinking is there have been a million different hypotheses about the function of the pectin, and I presume the Conus papillaris as well. But I think the bulk of the thinking now is that this is a structure to provide nutrients and enhanced oxygen to the inner retina. Lacking a blood supply, lacking an intrinsic blood supply, both the reptiles and the birds. Just some, I think, pretty pictures to show the complexity of some of these reptiles. These structures right here, the empty spaces would be the oil droplets, like I showed you in the turtle. Here's near the shell of fovea. You can tell it's the fovea because these are ganglion cells, a much more higher number. This is a gecko. This is an iguana, again, a fairly shallow fovea. I don't know of any lizards that have more than one fovea, and we'll get to that when we talk about the birds. Snakes. Snakes, a characteristic feature of snakes is that they've lost a lot of intrinsicity in their eye. They have no bone or cartilage in their sclera. There's no annular pad in the lens. Now, they have smooth muscle and not skeletal muscle in the uvea. They have blood vessels that many snakes. Some snakes have a Conus papillaris, but many snakes have blood vessels on the inner aspect of the vitreous, very much like some of the fish did. Not really retinal blood vessels, but a vascular structure within the vitreous. And they do have photomechanical movement of the inner relationship between the pigment and the photoreceptors. And then they have a unique structure adapted that we really only see in snakes, and that's the spectacle. I guess it probably should be referred to as the tertiary spectacle, because the double cornea in the fish, because of the way it develops, is sometimes referred to as a spectacle as well. In veterinary medicine, we usually just call this the spectacle. And here's the diagrammatic picture of the snake eye. The spectacle is developed embryologically from a fusion of the lids. Snakes don't have tear glands, and they don't have tears. So they maintain the corneal surface moist by having a closed-off space. And then they have a cuticle layer on the top of their spectacle that doesn't require lubrication, either for nutrients, or one of the functions of the tear film in the eye is to provide a glassy, smooth surface for light to interact with, and the cuticle provides that function in the snake eye as well. And here's a low magnification across the head of a snake. Here's the cornea, here's the spectacle. Everything else is sort of as expected. And again, here's the cornea, here's the spectacle. I don't have too much to say about that. Here's this structure right here is the cuticle. I get annoyed when people say that the snake sheds its skin. Of course, that's ridiculous if you think about it. Snake doesn't shed its skin. It just sheds this layer right here, which is totally keratin. It's acellular and totally keratin. Even veterinary ophthalmologists will say that snakes shed their spectacle. Well, again, they don't shed any more of their spectacle than they do anywhere else in the skin. They only shed this cuticular keratinous layer. The spectacle is vascularized. Remember, a lot of the nutrients to the front of the cornea in the mammal comes through the tear film, which, remember, we don't have in the snake. So in order to provide a blood supply to the spectacle, it has to have an intrinsic blood supply. And this is a latex injection in a snake to illustrate the presence of a blood supply in the spectacle. If you find a snake skin, you'll see that the cuticle over the spectacle is uniquely transparent, which shouldn't be surprising. This just shows the vascular structure spread over the inside of a snake species that has such a thing. I love pictures of the retina. I don't know much about what the relationship between structure and function is in some of the images I'm showing, but they have beautiful retinas showing a variety of different photoreceptor phenotypes, presumably with complex and probably very interesting functional applications. Here's a snake species that has something like a Conus papillaris. It has a vascular plexus that extends not along the surface of the cornea, of the retina like this, but directly into the vitreous, much like the Conus papillaris. Crocodilians, I don't have, again, I don't have too many crocodilians, but again, there's cartilage, there is a small annular pad, skeletal muscle. There's no Conus papillaris, there's no blood vessels in the retina. The retina entirely gets its blood supply from the choroid, which is a phenomenon we see in a number of different mammals as well. And there is still photomechanical movement, but pigment with regard to the retinal pigment epithelium. Crocodilians, here's a very thin annular pad, somewhat analogous to what I showed you in the turtle. Now we get to the bird eyes. This is a dissected head of a great horned owl. Again, the purpose here is to show, like I did in that reptile, I mean in that iguana, how the relationship between the size of the eyes and the size of the brain. This is an image that Ivan Schwab sent me of a frozen head from a great horned owl that, again, shows this is the brain up here, and all of this black and stuff is eye. Notice that the great horned owl has a tubular eye. Of course, it could only have that if it had a real prominent bone in the eye. So there's cartilage, well-developed bone, skeletal muscle in both the iris and the ciliary body. Not only that, but the complexity and the intrinsic in the sophistication of the skeletal muscle in the ciliary body is at least potentially quite a bit enhanced, and I'll show you what I mean by that. There's still photomechanical movement in the RPE. We have this structure called the pectin oculi, which is analogous to the Conus papillaris in the lizards. It's common for birds to have a fovea. Not every bird has a fovea, but it's also fairly common for birds to have two fovea. For instance, all of the diurnal raptors that I know of have two fovea, two parts of each retina adapted for high visual acuity. And some other surprising birds, like hummingbirds, have two fovea. They have a phenomenon which I'll try and describe called corneal accommodation. In addition to changing the lens, they can also change the shape, the contour of the cornea to help with accommodation. I don't know what I just did. And they have trichromatic vision or more. Several birds have four color variants of their photoreceptors. This is a lunai. This is something called a fairy bird. And again, this picture is mostly, again, taken to show how big the eyes are with regard to the head. This structure right here is the pectin oculi. It's the vascular structure that extends up from the inner aspect of the retina and presumably enhances the oxygen level of the vitreous for the benefit of the inner retina. Again, notice that because of the bone, you can see the bone right here, the shape of the eye no longer has to be spherical. The rigidity of the mammal eye is based on intraocular pressure in that you have to go through some contortions if you want any shape other than a spherical eye. This is a loon eye, and loon is one of those species that likes to see both above and below water. So the loon will have an eye which maximizes the flatness of the cornea. It can't completely maximize the flat. If you could have a flat cornea, it would be like diving glasses. Then your optics would be the same above water and below water. But I think you can even see from this magnification that the iris is extremely muscular, and again, the loon can change the curvature of the anterior surface of the lens to enhance that accommodative mechanism. Many birds, probably most studied is the chicken, have a skeletal muscular structure in the front of their uvea, which is anchored on the bone in the back and on this kind of ligamental area here, which is in the corner of the cornea. And when that muscle is active, it'll pull the edges of the cornea flat and enhance the curvature of the front of the cornea, which in addition to the action of the lens, will allow a chicken to be able to look at things that are extremely close. A chicken can look in focus right up to the end of its beak, which is way, way, way beyond anything that a mammal can do. And if you're over 50, the primates have, by morphology, have the best accommodation of any of the mammal. And if you're over 50, your only accommodation is to do this, and usually you lose these, so you're in trouble. That just shows the muscular iris. This is a puffini. And here's just an illustration from Walls that shows that enhanced curvature of the anterior surface of the lens. This is a work that Jim Verhoeve did. He's an electrophysiologist at the medical school, and they have a electrical test for retinal function now called the electroretinogram. They've had that for quite a while. But recently they've developed what's called a multifocal electroretinogram. And rather giving a global electrical image of the retina, the multifocal gives you a reading from each little octagonal space there, so you can see the distribution of the intensity of the electrical elements of the retina. And here's a horse, and you can see there's a rather dull hill of increased electrical function across the area that has the most cones and also has the most ganglion cells. And here's the human, and this is the mountain in the middle is where the fovea is. And here's the red-tailed hawk. It has two foveas. I have no idea what this means functionally or how it sees, but it's a beautiful image that illustrates the electrical implications of having two fovea.
Dick, how are these? Can you say a little bit more about how these images are?
These ones?
Yeah, you know, in other words, how are these measurements made?
So the electroretinogram, as you might predict, shows a bunch of squiggles. There's a downward squiggle, which is thought to be the depolarization of the change of the photoreceptors, and then there's a complex series of squiggles.
But it's obtained by putting an electrode right on the surface.
Yes,
of the eye.
You shine a light in. You put electrode on, then you shine a light in the eye, in the dark adapted eye, and then you measure the electrical changes.
Okay, so you're sweeping across the eye.
No, I don't think you're sweeping. Maybe Jill or Dr. So can explain it better.
Eye, and then you're stimulating different parts of the brain.
Yeah.
So because you're concentrating the stimulus on a specific area,
yeah.
And you do that all the way over the eyes, one little bit at a time.
If you were going to make the measurement over the whole eye, there's a complex system so that light is distributed equally over the whole eye. But here it's the opposite. You want a series of brrr, because it flashes in different parts of the eye almost simultaneously. But and those are measured, then those are calculated separately. That's the best that a pathologist can do with describing.
So every little hexagon is going to have its own little squiggle. Mm-hmm. So the amplitude of every little squiggle is going to be different. So it is getting high squiggle
right
where that mountain is, and then
we
get little squiggles.
Okay, thank you.
So this is a hawkeye dissected down, and we're looking at a high magnification of the gross image. Here's the pectin oculi, and here's what the one of the fovea would look like. So you can see these and focus in on them if you want to sample that area specifically. I think we're going to go beyond that. This is the pectin oculi. It's this complex vascular structure that extends into the vitreous from the optic nerve, and you can see, unlike the conus papillaris, which is rather primitive from the architectural point of view, is rather primitive. This in most birds has this very complex plicated folding mechanism, and then it's held across the top by a band of tissue. I've always been impressed by how rigid this structure is, and when you look at it histologically, there's absolutely nothing to give it rigidity. But I took a little tissue paper and folded it up like a plecal like that, and you put something across the top, and lo and behold, it's very rigid. It's just a vascular structure. So Dr. Schwab arranged for us to get a ductal planoplacy, there are several interesting features. They have cartilage in their sclera. They have no muscle in their ciliary body. They have trichromatic photoreceptors, which, remember, most mammals don't. They have photomechanic movement, which, again, no mammals do, as far as I know. So they have no annular pad. They have a lens very much like a mammal. And so I don't have a whole lot to say about that, at least not in this venue, but they have very interesting eyes, just as I'm sure you're all aware. The platypus is a very interesting creature. And now I'm going to diverge a little bit. I'm not going to talk about mammals by class. I'm going to talk about mammal eyes according to functional variations. It's 1 o'clock. People can leave. I'll try and go through this as fast as I know how to. This is just an example of a couple of mammal eyes, a lion eye and a rhinoceros eye. No cartilage, no bone, no skeletal muscle. the nocturnally adapted eye. The goal here of a nocturnally adapted eye is to take in as much light as possible. You think of your camera, you open up your f-stop, you have a big lens to get as much light as possible into the eye, and then to focus that on a small area of the eye as possible. So nocturnal animals that are adapted for nocturnal vision tend to have a big picture window cornea, and then they have a very round lens. So if you draw a line through the optical center of the eye, it tends to be towards the center of the eye or even in back of the center of the eye. The goal being to focus everything so that light is enhanced. Animals that have diurnal vision are adapted for diurnal vision. It's the opposite. They tend to have a fairly small cornea. They tend to have an optical center of the eye, which is very far forward. They tend to have a more flattened lens. The goal here now is they got plenty of light, so they want to get as much visual acuity as possible. So they want to form an image on as big a piece of the retina as they possibly can. So they want the optical center of the eye to be as forward as possible. And if you could make the eye elongated by having a bone in it, all the better. So this is a spring house, which is a rodent. My understanding is that it's a rodent. It's a very nocturnally adapted rodent. It's one of the few rodents that has a tapetum. But this, what I wanted to show you is the eye. It's got a big amount of cornea as compared to the rest of the eye. The optical center of the eye is pushed backwards. If you go to the zoo and you go to the nocturnal animals things, there's usually a picture outside that says animals that live in the dark have to have a big eye. And it's true, the better your vision is, the bigger your eye, that's true. But animals that live in the light want to have a big eye too, to have a big image. But the thing about the nocturnal animals is a large part of their eye is devoted to cornea, so they have more of their eye that's showing. Again, it always kind of upsets me when I see that image, but that's the truth of the matter. So here's a diurnal eye. This is an orangutan, and you can see the relatively flat cornea, forwardly positioned, a relatively small cornea, and then here we have the fovea right in the optical center of the eye. Well-developed fovea. Oh, and here's the muscles of accommodation, very robust compared to the muscles of accommodation of other mammals. This is an eye that's not adapted for bright light vision, but probably not for visual acuity. And this is a ground squirrel eye. And they have many of ground squirrel eyes. Here's several of them across here. Rather than a round optic nerve, they have an optic streak, a linear structure, all except the flying squirrel, which of course is a nocturnal animal. And then they also have, many animals have a yellow pigment in their lens. In part, again, it provides some protection from UV light. But these ground squirrels, this particular one is a prairie dog eye, have an intensely yellow lens. Horses and primates, for that matter, also have yellow, but not nearly as intensely yellow as these. It was thought for a long time that the ground squirrels, like the 13-line ground squirrel, had a purely cone retina, but it's since been learned that they do have a phenotype of rod in their retina as well. But just to look at electron micrography, you'd think that they were all cones, and you can see here. They have, although they don't have photomechanical movement of the melanin, these ground squirrels are the only mammals that I know of that have this shading effect. I think it's shaded and it's always shaded. It doesn't change, but I think you think of your prairie dog. The sentinel prairie dog comes out of the thing and basically sits there looking for predation from above. So they're spending their day peering at the bright sky for looking for predation from above. So I think that's why it's important for them to have an adaptation to be able to have functional vision under very bright light circumstances. And then you get your cetaceans and your pinnipeds. Again, we get animals that want to have vision both above and below the water. The cetacean eye has an adaptation of an extremely rigid but very thick, no bone, but they have a very thick posterior sclera. In part, that allows them to have a relatively flat cornea. They can reduce their pupil to a very small size, basically a pinhole, so that above water, the pinhole effect of the pupil obviates some need for accommodation. But of course, if you have a pinhole camera, you don't get very much light through it, so it's not all that functional. Otherwise, the pinniped doesn't have any other
accommodations for vision both above a relatively flat cornea and then the pinhole cornea. The pinniped eye is a wonderment. First of all, they have about the biggest. The biggest eye I have in my collection of vertebrates is the elephant seal. Next is the giraffe, next is the horse, next is the ostrich. But these pinnipeds have huge eyes. They have an area on the front of the eye which is flat, which I have some theories about how that happens, but they have little to do with physics. And they have direct connection between the ciliary body and the lens. You can see that by the pigment here. They have very sophisticated musculature of the ciliary body. And people are beginning to make speculations about how adaptations for vision both above and below water occur, but I'm not prepared at this point in time to speculate on. This is we took one seal and we cut it in the opposite the plane that we usually do, and you can see that unlike any other mammal that I'm aware of, the ciliary processes of the uveal tract attach directly to the lens. And again, I have some theories about what the significance of that is, but they're not worth sharing here. And then the tapetum, I talked about the tapetum a little bit. It's a feature we see in a lot of eyes that are adapted for dim vision. So we see them in a variety of different types of animals. Generally speaking, we see a cellular tapetum in the carnivores and a fibrous tapetum in your larger herbivores, including the cetacean, probably from the evolutionary standpoint. And we'll see occasionally a tapeta in other groups. I have a picture of the American opossum because they have a distinctly different type of tapetum.
Are they guanine based?
Pardon me?
Are they usually guanine, but they still
guanine? No, none of them are guanine. They're either cellular, in which case the reflective element is either zinc protein complex in the carnivores, in the canids, or a riboflavin protein complex in the felids, mm-hmm. or they're collagen, mm-hmm. a fibrous tapetum. With the exception of the opossum, which I'll show you in a second. So this is the tapetum is responsible for this phenomenon we refer to as eye shine. This is a canid cellular tapetum. The reflective elements are these little rodlets within each individual cell. This is the felid tapetum, which is usually very thick. It also has kind of a tinctural element to it. It stains, we use this melanin A stain in pathology to identify melanocytes when there's no melanin. And peculiarly, the tapetal cells stain with melanin A as well. And you can also, if you're lucky, you'll also see that the junction between the tapetum and the choroid has some cells that have melanin pigment in them. So I think they're basically melanocytes. The feline tapetum is autofluorescent. That riboflavin protein complex is autofluorescent. The canid tapetum is not. This is a hyena, which has a feline type of a tapetum. It's autofluorescent there. And then we have your fibrous tapetum lucidum, which we find in your herbivore species, including the cetaceans. Cetaceans have a huge tapetum. I don't know why, but both the tapir and the hippo, which are not that close, phylogenetically are not that closely related, both have not only a fibrous tapetum, but an extensive, robust, very, very thick fibrous tapetum. I can't figure out why that is. This is the opossum, which now, going back to your fish, has a retinal tapetum, and they have a reflective element in the retinal pigment epithelium, and I don't know what that element is. It's not guanine. I don't know what it is. And then there's your fruit bats that have an interesting modification of their retina and choroid that people speculate about what the cause of it is. They have this corrugation. You can see it here. You can see it in the half a little bit there. This series of hillocks between the retina and the choroid. You'd think this would do anything but help form an image on the retina. The speculation is that they'd have no blood vessels. So the speculation is there's a blood vessel that pops up out of the middle of each one of these little volcanoes of pigment, and the speculation is that it provides an even vasculature to the inner retina. I guess I can't offer anything better than that. So that's in some ways just kind of a hodgepodge of interesting things among about mammal eyes. I hope I've left you with the impression that we have. I'm impressed with our collection of normal eyes from a variety of different species. I want to thank all the various people in my lab, particularly Kate Lieber, who is my lab manager, and everything would come to a grinding halt if she didn't manage my lab, because we need a lot of management. Chuck Schobert, who's like sort of considered my research coordinator and is now very enthusiastic about evolution. Many thanks to Ivan Schwab. I refer to him as the Indiana Jones of comparative ophthalmology, because he'll travel anywhere and make friends with anybody to get an interesting specimen of an eyeball. And like I said before, I receive a lot of specimens from the different collections around the country, to which we're very grateful. Janice Loken is the histologist at the medical school. We send virtually all of our, we pay more, but we spend virtually all of our exotic eyes to her, because we love the quality we get back. And then I become a bit, active in the Eye Research Institute, which provides, if nothing else, moral support for the work that I do. I didn't really include very much invert, but this is the skin, the integument of the hagfish, and these are all mucus-producing cells. Again, they have the most sophisticated mucus-producing elements. This is krill, and this is a interesting species of squid with the right and left eye that have different functions. So I've gone over a little bit. I apologize for that.
Is it a fair interpretation to say that the it looks that if you within the amnio, you know, you've got the reptilia and you've got the mammal, the mm-hmm. living thing, that it looks like the mammal gave up to some extent on vision for a time?
I would definitely say the morphology supports
factor.
That as a.
Yeah.
I would definitely say the morphology supports the mammals and the snakes, support that as a hypothesis.
Yeah.
Do they begin as nocturnal? Principally the mammals, that's what I think of.
Wish we
did. Well, the thing that comes to mind is olfaction. You know, mammals are so good at olfaction,
right.
And whiskers, you know, tactile input.
But I think of them as starting off as being principally olfactory and nocturnal, and then secondarily coming back.
And about middle age, too. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering about how much you know or don't know about the similarities in terms of how these eyes develop. So I'm interested, like you said, the hagfish looks embryonic.
Yeah.
We were talking about the lamprey and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But even just in terms of over lifetime, so our eyes do certain things
mm-hmm.
over our lives that change. How much?
First we can read and then we can't read. No.
Yeah, exactly. How much of is some of that development both early and late? Has anybody looked at how similar that is across different species?
So among the vertebrate, I think there's the zebrafish, for instance, now is being used as a model for a lot of different hereditary eye functions, as well as eye function in general. And the at least the morphology of the developmental stages of the zebrafish eye is almost indistinguishable from that of the mammal eye or the bird eye or whatever. The amazing thing about the fish is you go from a fertilized egg to basically a fully developed eye in about 72 hours. It's just incredible. Well, thank you. It was fun.